Assalamu alaikum. This episode features Dr. Amani Hassani, who is the 2020 Sociological Review Fellow at Keele University in England. She talks about facing harsh scrutiny for her public scholarship and about fighting against Islamophobia and racism against Muslims in Denmark. Her struggle is the struggle of so many in Europe. You must check out her latest contribution to the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance. The European Islamophobia Report 2020 will come out in May, and you can find it on www.islamophobiaeurope.com, and I will place a link for last year's report in the show notes. I have to say that a lot of what Dr. Hassani talks about I found quite shocking on how blatant the Islamophobia in some countries is, such as Denmark, and I hope you find this as eye-opening as I did. Please support a diversity of voices in podcasting by liking, subscribing, reviewing, and or sharing the podcast. Now to Dr. Hassani. Assalamu alaikum, Amani.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Alhamdulillah. Thank you so much for doing this with me.
Thank you for having me. I'm really honored to be a part of this conversation and part of this podcast.
I know that you do a lot of interviews for media outlets, and I love, love, love how you use your expertise in a way that is public-facing. I know a lot of academia is inward and insular, and some academics even look down on being public-facing as if that's not academic enough. Was this a conscious choice on your part, and what did this path look like for you?
I think it was a conscious choice for me. I think it took me a while to actually get out there and think about how and what I wanted to contribute to the public forum, what in my research is actually beneficial for the public to know and gain from. So it took me a while to figure out how I wanted to engage with the public and what I could bring to the table. I think once I figured that out, then I slowly began to collaborate with different people and just figure out how also to promote other people to actually get out there and bring their work forward. So yeah, I think it was a conscious choice. I'm still very early on this route of figuring out how to engage with the public. But I think it's an important part of my academic work because I work with Muslims, community I myself am a part of, and a community I find is experiencing increased vilification in the public forum. And I think it's important to speak against this.
Have you had any experiences that left like a bad taste in your mouth from your public-facing adventures?
Yeah, I think so. I think I've experienced a lot of, so it's also like the trial and error, figuring out how you want to engage and who you want to engage with. I think for me, it was really important to figure out. I've written a lot on Islamophobia recently, and engaging and presenting this Islamophobia work to a broader public and, you know, more mainstream media has been a real challenge. I've had Danish media really go after myself and my work for actually bringing Islamophobia to the forefront of Danish debate. And I think, you know, thinking of Islamophobia as more of a structural issue rather than, you know, a single event or an individual problem or on the fringes of society, and actually saying, no, this is actually part of the fabric of political discourse in today's Danish society has been very, very controversial. So much so that I actually have a hard time engaging with Danish media. I find it's much easier to engage with more international media, bringing out what's happening in the Danish context more to an international audience, because a lot of these things happen in the Danish language and the world doesn't speak Danish. So, right. So it's also figuring out what benefit is there to just speak within a Danish context, and what's the positive side of also engaging within a more international forum.
Did any of these experiences leave you feeling sort of deflated, or did you ever think about not pursuing this particular path, not being public facing?
Yeah, I think so. So I'm thinking of a specific incident recently over the summer where I presented. So I had written an Islamophobia report on Denmark, and it was in the English language. So I looked at the Danish politics in 2019, the media, the judicial developments within Danish society, and actually highlighting how an Islamophobic rhetoric and framing and racialization of Muslims has actually just been been exacerbated. And so when I launched this as part of a grassroots organization that I work with in Denmark, Center for Danish Muslim Relations, it created this backlash with mainstream media, who framed it as trying to stifle Danish freedom of speech, which is very typical Wow. when you're actually speaking truth to power, right? So I would say that was very, very overwhelming, because all of a sudden I went from not being a very public figure and not having a platform within the Danish context, at least, to having a lot of focus on me and my work. And I think that was really overwhelming. I think one thing that was easy for me is the fact that I don't live in Denmark. So I was born and raised in Denmark and I do research on Denmark, but I don't live there. So there was, I was able to distance myself from it. But I know from a lot of activists who live in Denmark and who work and do their activism in Denmark, it is often very overwhelming. For me, I had an ability to just take a step back and go a little bit inwards. But I think it is overwhelming. I think it's important for us to figure out, how do we balance this? Also, because it's very easy that can distract you from really important work that you actually have to get on with.
Right. Man, that's such an important point. I mean, I'm glad that you're doing this work and that it centers on Islamophobia in particular. How do you define Islamophobia? Like, is it for you more a focus on people who hate or who misunderstand Islam, or those who racialize Muslims, or both, or some combination of that?
So I see this as a very important question. And it's also, so there's several layers to the definition of Islamophobia. I'm not too concerned with, you know, having a clear-cut definition. And I'll explain that in a second. I think for me, Islamophobia is part of a racialized social system. So it can't be disconnected from other types of racism. So I understand Islamophobia as a racism directed towards Muslims and expressions of Muslimness or perceived Muslimness. Right. So, and I think seeing it as part of a racism connects it with a wider history of racism. And it's so important also to connect it with the racialization of Muslims. And I'm going to explain a little bit why I think this definition is really helpful to think with. Not to say this should be set in stone, but from within the context that I work in Denmark and in Quebec, these are two contexts that do not have the same history of dealing with racism as we know in the US or the UK or other places. They're also two contexts that haven't dealt with their colonial history, seeing themselves as beyond racial. Mm-hmm. Or where race is not a problem. We don't mm-hmm. even speak about race in Denmark. We don't. Racism is a remnant of World War II and the fringes of Nazi Germany. So it's in public imagination, it's seen as on the fringes of society. But if you're trying to dismantle and understand what racism is within Denmark, you actually have to go back to these ways of racializing others within the context. So in Denmark, where Muslims are the most visible minorities, they become racialized in the public imagination through political discourse, through media representation or stereotyping of seeing the Muslim as the quintessential other within societies. So what do I mean with this? So basically just through both physical features, so being brown skin, coming originating from the global south, from being non-Western. So in Denmark, we don't speak about races within Danish legislation, but we do speak about non-Western people. Oh, now, wow. Who are these non-Western people? If you look at the political rhetoric within Denmark, it's often presumed that they're very religious. What kind of religion are they? it's presumed that they're Muslim. Right. In every sense of the word, but you can't specify Muslim as a category because of the Danish constitution. So one way of bypassing that racialization is by saying non-Western. But in Denmark, we know it's public's imagination. Non-Western means Muslim. Right. Now, this isn't to say that other types of racism aren't very real in Denmark. Anti-Black racism is very part of Danish society and just also Danish history of being a previous slave nation. That's a reality that hasn't been unpacked within Danish society. That's not something we talk about. We don't talk about Denmark's slave owners in the West Indies. So I think there's a lot of things that Islamophobia is expressed as Islamophobia today, but actually has roots in other types of racialization of Black people in Denmark, but also like xenophobia and anti-immigration sentiments. So if we see Islamophobia as a type of racism, it opens up the conversation to much more complex horizon of a way of understanding society, because the focus is not on the other. The focus is on the system that perpetuates the image of the other. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. Like, I think that encapsulates exactly why Islamophobia is so pernicious and must be talked about and must be fought against. Obviously, when it comes to the Danish context, you cannot talk about Islamophobia without also talking about the cartoon controversy. And this is something that, you know, US audience is very familiar with. Like, whenever they think of Muslims and their opposition to free speech, they think of the Danish cartoon controversy. What happened and how was that incident then used to feed Islamophobic agendas?
So the cartoon crisis is a really interesting example of how the racialization of the Muslim plays out in a media context. One thing that most people outside of Denmark are not necessarily aware of is that cartoons didn't come out of the blue. It actually came from political rhetoric from the government at the time, which was about saying that to the prime minister and the cabinet at that time, they tried to create this idea of we need to preserve Danishness. We need to preserve Danish values. And how do we do that? Is by fighting this idea that Denmark has to be multicultural or has to be a diverse society. Mm-hmm. We, the same week that the cartoons were published, the Minister of Cultural Affairs highlighted that we can't see Muslims as, or Islam as an equal. Islam is a religion of the Middle Ages, you know, going back to those Orientalist images of Muslims as backwards and, you know, patriarchal and against any types of equality and essentially a threat to our liberal values in Denmark. So that's kind of the framework that the cartoons were published. The cartoons came out of this idea of we're being threatened by this Muslims and Islam as a religion who wants to stifle our freedoms and our freedom of speech. And this is in a country where 95% of the country is white and the Muslims are an even smaller minority of few percents of the population with very little political power, with very little media platform. So it goes to show you in Denmark that the media did not, I think, and politicians did not expect it to blow up in a globalized way as it did, because oftentimes these debates and these ways of expressing, these ways of vilifying Muslim Danes and Muslim citizens within Denmark oftentimes happens without anyone noticing because right. No one speaks Danish, right?
Right.
So, but cartoons are kind of a global language. People could see the vilification of the Muslim other through these pictures. And I think this is where the cartoon crisis really became a global symbol of what's going on in Denmark, where the fight of liberal values became an oppressive tool to oppress their minorities within the country.
Right. I mean, it's so ironic that that's the platform that they fight upon is freedom of speech while they're actively stifling their own minorities within their country. It's just ironic and sad and
there's an
excellent example of white fragility.
Yeah, well, I think there's an important point to say here, because in the summer when I did publish that Islamophobia report, the editor-in-chief of the biggest newspaper in Denmark highlighted how this report was a way of stifling politicians and media, their rights, their freedom of speech. While as a minority, me speaking as a Muslim minority, highlighting racist tendencies within the very powerful elite structures of Danish society, that was seen as stifling the freedom of the powerful elite. Do you see how it's kind of reversed? The same thing with the cartoons. It's the minority who actually in real effect have no power within society to affect it. They're the ones who are threatening the people on the power, you know, the people who are powerful, who can
Right.
actually crush any voices dissenting their politics.
Yep, 100%. I definitely sympathize with this particular form of attack because I've seen it so many times in liberation movements where things are turned on their head and somehow the liberatory movement is blamed for causing the stifling of speech and causing chaos and so on and so forth. I wanted to also ask you about something that would come off quite controversial in the US context, and I was wondering if you could shed some light on it. There's a law called the Ghetto Law in Denmark. And first I wanted to ask, like, why is it called that? But also I wanted to talk a little bit about what is this law?
That's a really good question. So this is something that a lot of grassroots organizations that we're working together within the Danish context to kind of to work against this law. So this is a government law. The government named it the Ghetto Law. The government instilled the policies within the Ghetto Law, and the government is curbing the citizens and you know residents of public housing's rights to live in these houses based on these laws. So the ghetto law is a it's actually a set of laws that first of all categorizes public housings in troubled areas, in ghettos and hard ghettos. Now the hard ghettos, to be on the list of hard ghettos, one of the main criteria is that there needs to be more than, I think it was 40 or 50% non-Western immigrants and descendants that are residing within this neighborhood. Now, what
Wow.
does this mean? This is a direct law by the Danish government to say that if a housing area has more than 50% or public housing area has more than 50% non-Westerners, they could be Danish citizens, but that doesn't matter in terms of this law. The whole neighborhood will need to be gentrified. There needs to be a change in residence. And a lot of families are looking. So these laws were implemented 2 years ago and they're now coming into effect. So we're seeing a lot of families being evicted from their houses. So the municipality has to gentrify these houses to kind of get way of this labeling of being a hard ghetto. Now, with that, there's also things like double sentencing. If you commit a crime within neighborhoods, there are things like enforced nurseries on one-year-olds for more than 25 hours to instill Danish values.
Oh my God.
There's a lot of controversial aspects of this package of laws that really, there's no other way of saying it than explaining it as structural racism from the top down, with the idea of saying we want to work against parallel societies within Denmark. This idea of people living within these neighborhoods are they are not productive and contributing citizens of Danish society. Now, the underlying tone under this is also selling a lot of public housing stock and basically changing the residents from brown to white residents.
Essentially, I mean, that's literally what, if the criteria is non-European immigrants and their descendants, that essentially they might as well have just said white and everybody else.
Exactly. So basically, if because in Danish categorization of citizens, they don't have different racial categories, but they will stipulate if you are of non-Western descent. And this is a way of regulating housing, a way of regulating a lot of different social policies with Danish society. It's just a way of bypassing the Danish constitution that does not allow for discrimination against any ethnic or religious minorities.
You know, I mean, we have a lot of racism in the US, but I'm just shocked at how explicit the racism is in Denmark. That's just
It's
shocking.
interesting. So yeah, it's very shocking. I think sometimes when I translate these things to English, I am shocked at how it sounds in English because in Danish, imagine a society where you can't speak of structural racism. Then
Because they don't want to refer to races.
in a country where racism is an individual problem, it's
Right.
not, it can never be a political issue. It can never be from the state down, the state cannot be racist in its essence. So everything that is promoted and, you know, introduced through policy can be colorblind because we don't speak about racism, therefore racism doesn't exist. But inadvertently, Islamophobia is very much a part of the political rhetoric. So, for instance, with a different example, so the ghetto laws are a very direct example of structural racism, a way of kind of creating housing inequalities among citizens in Denmark. Another example is just the fact that Muslim faith-based schools, the government is, and the current government is social democratic, so it's on the left end of the center, right? Mm-hmm. They're trying to ban Muslim schools in Denmark, and they can't ban it directly because that would be a transgression of the constitution, but they can say that any schools that have a majority of non-Western immigrants and descendants need to be disentangled. So they haven't actually done this yet, but they are. This is one of the pledges of the current government. It's one of their voter pledges. So it's something that they're working towards. So if this isn't Islamophobia, and if this isn't a racialization of Muslims, wow, you know, through the way of non-Westerners, then this is a very clear example of that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'll say something as an aside, like oftentimes when I'm interviewing people, I'm also thinking about like, hey, let me see what I could use as an ad to promote the podcast. But the stuff you're saying, like literally everything you've said is so, so mind-blowing. It's so controversial. It's so downright racist. Yeah. I don't know what to pick because it's like everything.
You remember that Denmark, so a few years ago, I think, Denmark and the Danish population was voted the happiest people in the world.
Right, I remember.
You know? And the question is here, who did this survey actually ask? Because if you ask Muslims, in the past 20 years, it's been one hurdle after another in limiting their civil liberties, but in the guise of protecting progressive liberalism or Danish values, you know, of protecting Danishness. But Muslims in Denmark are experiencing, and, you know, not just Danish Muslims, Danish citizens, but also the way that immigrants and refugees are treated in Denmark. It's extraordinary what the Danish government can actually get away with.
Speaking of refugees, I read somewhere that the Minister of Refugees, Immigrants and Integration of Denmark commented on meher being an issue in abusive marriages. And then he said he intended to come up with a proposal that fights against this concept. So first of all, my question is, the entire idea of having a governmental post that is Minister of Integration, I mean, integration itself to me sounds so xenophobic, is it? I mean, it sounds like in the Danish context, people kind of just accept it.
Yeah, so it's accepted within this idea of, if you remember when we, like in the beginning of our conversation, we were talking about the otherization of Muslims and how this is kind of interconnected with otherization of other minorities, of Black Danes, but also immigrants and refugees. So this idea of integration is that these others need to adopt Danish values and Danish lifestyle to become actual contributing members of society. Now, I find like the Minister of Integration is just, it was a ministry that was made up, I think, about 20 years ago with this whole change of rhetoric of saying we need to preserve Danish values, we need to have immigrants integrate into our society. So this whole dichotomy between us and them was really, really highlighted with the Ministry of Integration. And now this idea of, you know, meher as a sign of a Muslim communities abusing their women, which is really far out. It's really a crazy notion.
I've always thought of meher as a feminist thing. So how are they seeing meher? Like, oh, I saw that comment as quite Islamophobic.
Yes, exactly. And I think this is where point of where Islamophobia, really the racialization of Muslims, is really pronounced. You know, why is meher even an issue when you're talking about immigrants or whatever, if you don't assume that they're Muslim? So the idea of meher in this context, or the way the integration minister describes it, is that he sees it as, he called it a bizarre deal, like a trade deal between two clans, basically. Muslim
God.
families selling their women to a clan or a man or
Wow.
whatever. Really, the racist assumptions within this idea of what mahr is or what Muslim marriages are is laden with racist images of Muslim women being oppressed, the men being aggressive, Muslim men being violent, the Muslim community being oppressive of their Muslim women. So now this is really outrageous in discourse and in rhetoric. Now the real issue comes when the government and the ministry is actually creating policies based on these assumptions. Now, the whole idea is controlling not just Muslim women's social and personal lives from the government, but also just surveilling the Muslim community as a whole.
Right.
You know, down to the very small details of intimate relationships between Muslim men and women.
Yeah. Oh, my God. This
Yeah.
obsession with protecting and liberating Muslim women, it's going to kill our community. I wanted to finally talk to you about Islamophobia in general, both specifically in Denmark, but I know you also research in Quebec. But
yeah.
I wanted to talk about the hostility that you have described towards Muslims, towards Muslim immigrants. It's unmistakable. And U.S. also has Islamophobic laws, especially when it comes to immigration. But within the Danish context, it sounds remarkably different than the U.S. context. What do you make of this particular flavor of Islamophobia?
You know, I think it's interesting to just compare the Danish versions of Islamophobia with the Quebec ones, for instance. The Quebec is very similar to the French way of expressing Islamophobia. So this idea of Muslims needing to be liberated, how do we go about it? It's by creating legislation and policies that actually curb their right to choose. For instance, in Quebec, some women can't wear niqab or hijab in public institutions, or hijabs, you can't work as a public servant wearing hijab. And I think this idea of regulating Muslim lives is a really useful way of thinking of Islamophobia. So Islamophobia, it's a way for the rulers to limit the agency of the ruled. Now, here in this context, it's a way for powerful structures for the government to curb the agency of Muslims in their self-expression, in their religious lives, in their religious practices even. And I think this is something that's, you know, it doesn't have the same expression in the US or not even the UK context have the same expression. In the Danish and in the Quebec and other countries that have a hard time actually saying and engaging and dealing with the idea and concept of racism and racialization, the way this is presented is very different than the US context. You can say a lot more about minorities and racialized others when you do not recognize that that's an issue in itself.
You can't refer to the issue itself.
Yeah, you can't talk about racism in Denmark. Saying the word racism, let alone Islamophobia as a type of racism, is very controversial. Islamophobia and racism is something that is on the fringes of society. It's the far right we're talking about. It's not the actual structures and fabric of power dynamics of Danish society.
Because they put it in a mask of values. They like put on a happy mask on it and say, oh, we're trying to preserve liberal values. We're trying to preserve
exactly.
democratic values.
Exactly, exactly. And with that, they're stifling the freedoms of the minorities of that country.
Excellent. I'm so glad that you're doing the work you are doing. You are 100% right that if it's not for people like you, it would be very difficult for people around the world, people like myself, people who are interested in this kind of stuff, to be aware of what's going on in the Danish context. Because I was actually trying to listen to some of your interviews before this, and some of them were in Danish, and I didn't know what was being said. And we definitely need somebody to be advocating this on a larger global stage so that the plight of Danish Muslims is brought to light, and that we stop thinking of European nations like Denmark, like France, as these enlightened places. So thank you for doing the work that you're doing. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate the vote of confidence. I hope I can live up to that. I think it's also important to say that these, you know, bringing this to a more global conversation is really important, because Islamophobia has a localized expression in all these different countries. And I think it's important to have this conversation on a global level because we need to understand how it plays out differently in different countries.
Definitely. Couldn't agree more. Thank you so much for coming on. I hope to be seeing more of your work. Can you tell people where to follow you?
Yes, I am on Twitter. I am not the best at social media, but I'm on Twitter. You can look me up under my name, Amani Hassani. And I try to share my research both in Danish and in English as much as I can. Currently writing up my book on the research that I kind of briefly presented today and much more. So keep an eye for that in the next little while. It'll take me a little bit of time to finish that up with the pandemic going on right now, but yeah, keep an eye out for my work. And I think thank you so much for giving me this platform. I think it is important for us to have these conversations across the Atlantic as well, and just learning from each other's research. And I think I really appreciate you giving this platform.
No, thank you, and we will definitely be looking forward to your book. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
I hope you found that informative. Please don't forget to leave a review for the podcast. Assalamu alaikum.